Welcome to Talking to Grandma. I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides, and we are close to wrapping up season two of Talking to Grandma. Can you believe it? If you haven't subscribed, rated, or left a review yet, we'd greatly appreciate it. Your ratings and reviews help us bring more stories from around the world straight to you. We each have unique identities that become even more complex when we have mixed heritage. In today's episode, Henry Yao shares how he heard the question, "What are you?" many times growing up with his Chinese Venezuelan heritage, and how the diverse community of Houston welcomed him and continues to inspire his work today. As a graduate of the University of Houston, Henry has become a seasoned professional in the field of public relations, a passionate advocate for diversity and representation in children's education, and has played a vital role in shaping the experience at the Children's Museum of Houston for the past 16 years. Welcome, Henry. We are so excited to have you on the show today.
It's likewise, like, so excited to be here.
Yeah, we've been able to connect and have a conversation previously, and it was, your story is so interesting, unique, not one that is generally told or elevated in the Latinx community around the diversity of what it means to be Latino. And so we thought it was really important to share your experiences and share your story. And so I'm just kind of going to dive into it with our listeners and would like to start with asking you to tell us where you're from, where did you grow up, and what brought you to Houston?
Absolutely. Well, so my parents are from Hong Kong, but I was actually born and raised in Venezuela. And I lived there till I was 12 years old and moved to the United States in 1994. And in 1998, moved to Houston. That's sort of like the timeline, right? And yeah. I've been in Houston ever since. But my parents, basically, they were in Hong Kong pretty much in their 20s. My parents met and they got married. And my dad was basically dirt poor when he got married. And he was looking for how to, you know, grow a family. And like, I have no funds. So his older brother owned a factory in Venezuela at the time. And my dad basically asked him to borrow money. And my uncle said, no. but he said, you can come work for me. And so my dad was like, okay, well, what do I have to lose? I have nothing here. And let me take my chances and go. So he basically went to Venezuela to work for my uncle to save up some money so he could then bring back to Hong Kong. But he was doing very well there. And he saw an opportunity there. He was just like, wow, this is actually, I think I can support a family here financially. Basically went back to Hong Kong, persuaded my mom to go to Venezuela. By the way, they didn't speak Spanish at all. They just kind of like winged it. And my mom's score was scared, but she also saw an opportunity. I don't know if you know, but Hong Kong is a super expensive city and it's crowded. And she was just like, well, you know what? Let's just go to a place where we can actually get a house to raise children. And sure enough, so she went along and so did my grandma. And she actually flew with my grandma on the plane and they didn't get along at the time. They never got along. But anyways, she sucked it up. And yeah, they all went to Venezuela. And next thing you know, we were born there.
So born in Venezuela, your parents were from Hong Kong. You were born in the Andes of Venezuela, which is very different than Hong Kong, as you said, in terms of like the big city. Are we talking Mérida, Táchira? What part of the Andes of Venezuela were you growing up at?
Táchira. So Táchira. Yes, it's on the western side of Venezuela. And actually, I grew up at the border between Venezuela and Colombia. So I'm from a small town called San Antonio del Táchira, and it is it borders Cúcuta, Colombia, which you might have seen in the news a couple of years ago when the borders were shut down between Venezuela and Colombia, and there was this huge exodus. And Cúcuta was a big point of where all the activity was happening. So yeah, that's where I'm from.
And so that's where you were at. And then at what age did you move to Oakland and what was that like for you?
Well, it happened. Let me tell you a little bit of a backstory. So my mom's sister. My mom's, they're seven children. My aunt, which is aunt number five, my mom is actually number six. My aunt number five lived in San Francisco at the time. And this was, I'm talking like in the 1980s. And she basically, you know, sort of suggested to my mom, hey, listen, I can sponsor your family to come to the United States if you ever are interested in coming to the United States. And of course, my mom being like, hey, you know, what the heck? I went to Venezuela and I didn't speak Spanish. Like, why not? So I had applied for basically like a sponsorship to come to the United States. Well, that took about 10 years from 1984 to 1994. The green card did not process. So in 94, I was 12 years old and I hear my mom, okay, we're moving to the United States. Like, let's pack our bags and we got to go. Like, so it literally was like the day after my birthday, you're like, okay, we're leaving. Say bye to your friends and we're leaving. And at the time, I didn't really know what that meant. Like, I was like, okay, well, we're leaving. I'm surely we're going to come back. We leave all my stuff. And yeah, little did I know that it was just like, well, you'll never see any of your stuff again. And came to the United States to live in Oakland, California. That's where my aunt lived. It was total lifestyle change. I mean, I'm talking about like I was in nature in the Andes in the mountains to like this urban landscape. It's suburban. I went from like a real jungle to like an urban jungle, and very much a culture shock for me, like completely different.
Yeah. And also, I think what's also really important about your narrative is that sometimes I think because of media or because of even as an educator, like what we see in school and curriculum and stories is that we don't see that like Latinx is not, or the Latino identity is not a race, right? Like that there are many different identities within that you can have folks that have different heritages coming and moving there. And so when you moved to Oakland, did folks see that? Were they like, okay, accepting you as Latino, accepting you as someone who was a part of that community? Or were they a little bit confused about who you were and where you came from?
Oh, I was super confused. I was what you call like an anomaly, like a unicorn. It's like, what the heck? Yeah. So people were completely confused, especially in a city like Oakland, California. It's where I would say a lot of the minorities are very cliques, right? Like the Latinos with Latinos, Asians with Asians, and so on. Not just, African-Americans, etc. So when I went into this middle school, the first thing I was asked is, what are you? And so I was like, well, I'm from Venezuela. So, but they were like, no, what are you? And to me, that concept of what are you, I didn't really understand it, because in Venezuela, I grew up with all my friends from kindergarten, and I ever been asked like what I was, because regardless, even though there wasn't a lot of diversity, I was already part of a community. Like I grew up with my childhood friends, like everybody knew who I was. Yeah, I might have looked different, but there was never a question of like, what are you? So in America was the first time where I actually saw like this sort of like, immediately, like, we need to identify you as this. And so I was like, well, I am Hispanic. But they're like, well, you look Chinese. And I, well, I'm also Chinese. They were like, are you mixed? And I'm like, well, no, I'm not mixed. My parents are from Hong Kong. They're like, well, then you're Chinese. I'm like, but no, I'm not quite Chinese. I grew up in Venezuela, so I'm Venezuelan. You know, they're like, well, not really. You're not Latino. You don't look like us. So it was sort of this huge challenge for me, because I immediately didn't fit in. I didn't look, even though I may have the cultural background of a Latino, I did not fit in with the Latinos immediately, because I did not look Latino. And likewise, it went with the Asians. They were like, well, you don't speak Chinese well enough, or at least like they were fluent, even though Chinese was actually my first language. But you know, as I grew older, like you kind of lose it when you don't really practice it. Yeah. And they're like, well, you speak Spanish, like how is that? So there was, for me, I was sort of the oddball, because I didn't quite fit in school, you know, when everybody was being a clique.
That must have been really hard, like you mentioned, not really having thought about it in that way or confronted with that question growing up and then not only like moving to a completely new context, having to deal with like the idea of making new friends, but add on top of that a layer of identity that folks just couldn't make sense of, or maybe were putting different labels on you. So how did that make you feel as a kid, and how did you handle that?
Oh, it was a huge learning curve. Of course, I felt like I didn't fit in. Like, that was the first time in my life where I actually felt like I didn't fit in, like I didn't belong here, because I couldn't, and this goes the other way around, I just could not identify with anybody here. It was rough, you know, but luckily I started in a ESL class. There were people who were sort of experiencing pretty much the same thing as I was, not necessarily in terms of identity, but sort of this culture change where they didn't happen to speak English. And so it was having that sort of moral support between classmates helped me get through a lot of stuff, even just the customs or, you know, word usage. You know, like in English, we use a lot of colloquialism, which we don't really like. In Spanish, you just go directly into what it is sometimes. In English, it's like, you know, and I always use this example because at the time, I never understood what it was. Somebody asked if I could hook them up with tickets. And I was like, hook up, like connect? Like, how do you connect with tickets? My mind did not trigger, you know, instead of like, hey, can you give me some free passes or anything like that? It was just like, hook me up. And I was like, what is hooking up? So a lot of that stuff, it was so very difficult for me to learn.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned you were in ESL classes, and that was an opportunity to meet with other folks, other students who were experiencing the same thing. ESL is English as a second language, and the focus in those classes is often to teach the English language and transition into a full English environment. So you moved at 10 years old and you were in that situation and moved into a full English environment, probably eventually right out of ESL and then into full English environments. How did you manage to maintain your Spanish language? Because you work professionally in Spanish now, like reading, writing, like still a very strong language for you. So how did you manage to maintain that?
It's a very excellent question. And actually, I didn't practice Spanish at all. I was actually not quite allowed to practice Spanish because my aunt did not speak Spanish. So the only way for me to communicate with her was either with English or Cantonese. So the only way for me to maintain Spanish was by speaking with my sisters. And that really was my only connection to Spanish. Of course, I kind of cheated the system. I had Spanish classes. Of course, I was the number one student in my Spanish class. They're like, wow, this Chinese guy really knows his Spanish. But that was my only connection with Spanish. At home, I had to really refocus myself on speaking Cantonese because my aunt, that was the only way that I could communicate with her. And because I didn't know English. So it was like really broken Cantonese at the time. I just remember, and also, you know, her own like mannerisms of doing things. Like we had to take off our shoes. Like we didn't do that in Venezuela. You just walk down the house with shoes on. And at her house was like, no, got to take off your shoes. You got to eat with chopsticks. She had no forks. It's just like, so there's this also culture shock at her house.
Well, interesting. And you have multiple heritage languages, right? So Cantonese is a heritage language of your family, and Spanish is your heritage language too, because that's the language that you grew up with. So how do you feel about both of those languages? Like, is it the same type of relationship with them? Like, is it different? What does that look like for you?
You know, Spanish and Cantonese are actually very similar in terms of like, they're kind of like very emotional, passionate languages. They're very expressive. It's very animated. Almost, if you even think about it, almost the jokes are very similar because, you know, in Hispanic culture, we have like a nickname for people. And like, we always do that in Cantonese as well. We nickname people. And I'm like, hey, this happens also in Spanish. Like, you know, damos apodos a todos, you know? So we do the exact same thing in Cantonese. So they're very similar in terms of, their language style. Cantonese, I would say, is a little bit more difficult because it's phonetic. It's a phonetic language. So you could say a word and it could mean something else. You could say something and it could mean something different because you're not using it phonetically correctly. Whereas Spanish, it's just like, you know, you follow the, you know, your vocabulary and your ABCDs, like it all sounds like there's a structure that you can follow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. If you can, what it says on the page is what it is. It's a syllabic language Spanish. So if you can, you know the Spanish alphabet, then you can basically pronounce all of the words. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So it must be different in that way. And so then how did you get from Oakland to Houston? Like, what was that journey like for you?
It was great. I actually, let me tell you, moving to Houston was probably a huge sigh of relief because that was actually the first time where I was like, you know what? I'm starting to fit in here. Mm-hmm. At the time, my sister had turned 18 and she wanted her freedom, her independence. She was like, I'm going to do my own thing. My aunt did not like that. She just felt like my sister was rebellious. She's like, I can't control her. Like, she's just too much. So my parents decided for other alternatives. It was either like, let's get another house in California. And they realized how expensive houses in California were. They're like, well, that's not an option. My mom's oldest sister, remember there were 7 kids, she actually was already living in Houston. She spoke to her sister and my aunt said, sure, I will take in your daughter and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. So my sister, seeing that could be her ticket out of to freedom, that she was just like, I'm moving. So she immediately came to Houston to live with my aunt. Sure enough, that also didn't work out. My other aunt here, she's like, your daughter's too much. And my mom just like, I'm just going to get her a house. So she got her a house. I was like, wow, my sister has a house. Why? How come we're not living with her? And that's when my middle sister and I pushed to move to Houston with her. And yeah, so that was in 1998. That's when we moved to Houston to live with my sister. My parents were not here yet. They were still in Venezuela. So for us, it was just like, wow, we get to do our own thing. No adults. Of course, my oldest sister didn't care. She's just like, I'm here to party. I'm here to go to the club.
Plenty of those in Houston.
Exactly. So basically, it was my older sister and I, we had the house for ourselves all the time. So it was a really fun time. Coming to Houston in school was a lot different than in California. I noticed, and I think it's, you know, when people say, yeah, Houston is really diverse, I mean, I'm really talking about I experienced it. Coming to Houston, in our school, there were so many people from so many different cultures, much more than in California.
And you went to A-Leaf, right? Yeah, I'm just going to name that because we probably have some listeners from Houston. So you went to A-Leaf.
Yeah, A-Leaf Hastings. Yeah. Coming to A-Leaf, and the diversity was incredible. That whenever I would tell people my story, they were just, okay, great. It wasn't even about my background. It was really more about intellect. When I came here, I was immediately, and I didn't think I was a great student, but I was immediately enrolled in all these AP classes. So all those AP kids, which is, they're it's like a multiverse. Like, you see them from all backgrounds. They didn't care about my background or, you know, who my friend was or et cetera. They only care about my academics. And so it was a great opportunity for me to focus on that. And that's when I really started making friends. And like, I actually felt like, hey, you know what? They don't really care about whether I fit in or whether I speak Spanish or Cantonese. They only care about whether I know my formulas for chemistry. Right? and that was a really sigh of relief in terms of, like, you know, what you're going through as a teenager when you're all hormonal and you're all emotional. Like, I didn't even have to worry about that stuff. I had to worry about my academics. And it was a really great experience. And the funniest thing is, when I came to Houston and I would tell people that I went to A-Leaf Hastings, they were like, oh, you go to Hastings? And I was like, it's great. Like, we have like IDs and like there's security everywhere. And I didn't think as A-Leaf as a bad school, because in California, it was awful. Like, in Oakland, the schools were really bad. I mean, we had fights every day. I mean, we had random shootings. And I never experienced any of that in A-Leaf.
So we could have a whole conversation about all the schools and the different districts and all of that, which I'm very interested in as an educator. Yes, definitely. You know, that's really important. No matter where you come from, no matter who you are, that you have a space that has a safe learning environment, right? That a learning environment that like is really good opportunity, that your teachers see the potential in you. And so unfortunately, that's not the case everywhere and for all students. And that's actually a lot of why I got into education is because like, it really matters where you go to school. Unfortunately, you don't, as a kid, you don't get to pick where you go to school. Unfortunately, in the US, there's a lot of disparities and there's a lot of inequities in school systems. So that is really tough. And I also resonate a lot with what you said about Houston being really diverse because I grew up in Houston and I don't think I really like appreciated it that much until I like left for a while. And when I come back, I'm like, you can feel the diversity in so many different places with all of the just different types of people that are in Houston. It's really beautiful. The diversity I love, the humidity I hate, but they both, you got to live with the humidity to take all the good things of Houston.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So how did you get into your career around journalism and storytelling? Like what motivated you to go down that path?
So my major was in accounting when I went to U of H. I went to U of H and I majored in accounting and my parents were like, wow, he's going to really make it. He's going to be great. And actually my first job was at a part-time job at ExxonMobil. In high school, I was part of the Business Professionals of America, which was like a program that would place you in different oil industries around town. And I got placed with ExxonMobil and I was in their accounting team. And I loved it and they loved me there. And yeah, but once I got into college and I started taking business classes and accounting classes, I realized that I didn't really like it. It was a lot different than I expected. I guess at work, the people made it fun. Whereas in school, I was like, wow, I really have to like know my stuff. And I was like, I really don't want to do this. I think I want to do commercials. Like, I think I want to like go behind the scenes and shoot stuff. And at the time, U of H's media production program was not very big on commercials, but I went into media production major there. And then I met my best friend there and he was interning at Telemundo at the time. And I was looking for an internship in production. And he's like, hey, listen, I know you're not interested in news, but hey, here's a great opportunity. I can get you in. I can get you to talk to the production manager and for an internship. And I was like, okay, sure, why not? So immediately, like within the week, I was in working for Telemundo. And little did I know that that would really change, it would alter the course of like my career. So at Telemundo, I was there for about 3 years. So throughout college, and then after I graduated during that time. And then after I graduated from Telemundo, they would not hire me because they were like, no, you need to go to a smaller market. This is how kind of journalism works. You have to go to a smaller market and get your experience. But I was like, no, I want to stay in town. By then, I had graduated with a double major. I had major in news, broadcast news, and media production because I realized that the news was a thing here in Houston. Yeah, so I double major and Telemundo would not hire me. And I was like, no, but I've been here 3 years. You guys should know me. And then next thing you know, this independent TV station from Monterrey, Mexico, is called Multimedios. They're opening an independent station here. So I went in and auditioned for a reporter job. And it was what they call, at the time, it wasn't called a multimedia journalist. At the time, we just called them a one-man band. So it was a one-man. So you had to shoot and edit your own stories. And I was thrilled because I was like, wow, this is a great opportunity to work in a top 10 news market. And it was just like, this is a dream come true, even though I was making scraps, but it was just like a dream come true. It's like, and I was there for about a year. Then I get a call from Fox 26 and they asked me to work for them. And I went in as a morning producer and then I hated it. I hated the morning hours.
Would you have to get up?
Yeah, I would have to be there at midnight. And my shift was like midnight to 8. Yeah. So, it was horrible. But it sort of gave me an incentive to like push myself out, like to also rethink like, where do I want to do this? Is this what I want to do? If I do it, it has to be 100%. If I don't, like, I just leave. And I realized that I could not do it 100%. I was good at it, but I didn't enjoy it. And that's when I knew I was like, I had to do a change. And so then my other friend was working for PR. And he said, hey, listen, why don't you look into public relations? And I was like, I don't know what they do. I don't know. Like, I knew I would get press releases from people, from publicists, but I didn't know exactly what that role was. And he's just look into it. It's very similar to journalism. And I think you're going to enjoy the 9 to 5 hours. And I'm like, 9 to 5? I get to party after work. So then, so I said to myself, if I leave the news industry, which I really love, it's just that I could just not do it with those hours. It has to be somewhere where I think I'm going to have a lot of fun. I remember doing a story as a reporter at the Children's Museum. And I was like, let me just see if they have any positions available. And there was a position available as a public relations associate. I applied. Within the week, they called me. And within the third week, I was already working at the museum. And 16 years later, I'm still here.
Yeah, that's amazing. 16 years at the Children's Houston Museum. That is amazing. It is a really fantastic museum. I've been to a lot of children's museums across the US, and Houston's definitely stands out. What I really appreciate about it is that it reflects the diversity of the city, that it is very intentional about that. And so I'd love to hear from your perspective, having worked there for, 16 years, why is that so important to y'all around, like, making sure that children are seen and reflected and can see their culture in science and nature and all the different things that you represent at the museum?
Absolutely. I could talk for hours about the museum. So very important. First of all, even in our staff, we want to reflect our cultures, our heritage. We want children to see themselves at the museum. We think it's very important for many reasons, because first, opportunities. A lot of children, especially minority families, don't think that they're going to be able to do this. But if they see somebody, hey, my gosh, this engineer looks just like me, or this, I don't know, inventor or this scientist. And then that may spark this idea like, hey, there's no barrier for you. And that's one of the biggest hurdles that we have to overcome as an institution, is moving these hurdles away from children and providing them opportunities to grow and to, to reach past those limits, right? I don't mean to be cheesy, but they are the future. The future can only be shaped by the present, right? So if we don't give those children those opportunities, then, those things can probably are not going to change. And so that's why it's very important. The other important part aspect is because we're such a diverse city, we want to be able to celebrate everyone. And so we really focus our efforts in really celebrating different cultures. We actually have an exhibit during the holidays called Seasons of Sharing that celebrates holidays celebrated around the world. Like we do, and even observations like Ramadan, Diwali, Lunar New Year, et cetera. And throughout the year, we celebrate Fiestas Patrias, we Mid-Autumn Fest, a lot of different things throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for us to also celebrate those things, because that's one thing that we don't want children to forget. Yes, they are in a new country. They are, and I'm speaking not just for immigrants, but for everybody. The heritage is important to carry out your legacy. And so we want to serve that as a reminder to them that this is embedded in their roots and that they should never forget. And so that's why that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think it gives children that sense of like belonging, the sense of it being possible, the sense of being seen. And they don't have that all the time in the world that surrounds them. So it's really important. And equally important, it's really important for children to see diversity in a positive light. If it's not them, to learn about different cultures, to learn about different types of people in a non-stereotypical way, in a way that is, truly authentically representing these different cultures. And so that's really great. We work with a lot of bilingual parents, families, and educators who are often looking for resources in languages other than English that are authentic and in the community. So I'm curious to know, is a Houston Children's Museum Do they offer programming in different languages? I know, like, even when I go, that the plaques and different activities that you have them in different languages, which is really great for accessibility. But how do you all think about language use at the museum?
Absolutely. So all of our signage is bilingual in English and Spanish, primarily because most of our, about 40% of our visitors are Spanish speaking. But that's not to say that we don't include other languages. Like, for example, we have several different literacy programs, particularly one called FLIP, which is the Family Literacy Involvement Program. And it's a program where children and their families can check out a book. But this book comes in a nice, beautiful bag that has an activity related to that book. Well, those activities are actually done in different languages. You can have them in Vietnamese, Chinese, Urdu, Spanish. I mean, you name it, we probably have it in several different languages. So we hugely make an effort to be very inclusive and also to make language like this thing that's just like, Hey, it's in a different language. Like, it doesn't have to be this like bizarre, like, why is it in this language? It's just like we offer those multiple options. And even our staff, we also have a requirement that at least 30% of our staff needs to be bilingual in English and Spanish. So, yeah, but even our staff, we speak, yeah. I mean, we probably speak 20 different languages just on site, like our staff. Like, we probably will find somebody who can translate.
Yeah. That's amazing. I love the intentionality behind that, and it really shines through. I just really appreciate you bringing that perspective and sharing with us that. And I hope folks go and visit the Children's Museum in Houston. As we close out, I want to end with a question around what brings you joy, Henry? What's bringing you joy these days? And what would you like to share with our listeners about the joy that you have?
so many things can bring me joy. Like, good food brings me joy. Travel brings me joy. From a bigger picture, I just like the opportunity to see how people can live and let live. I think that brings me joy. Yeah. I think there's a lot of judgment, especially nowadays, and a lot of criticism about how things should be or how they shouldn't be. And, when it comes down to, I think the simplicity of life, just letting people do their thing, be who they are, be who they want to be. I think that really brings me joy. And I wish, when I see, different events throughout the city celebrating not just like diversity, but diversity in terms of, everything, preference or just different likings. It's just letting people be who they want to be and just live and let live. Mm-hmm. So I think that really, really makes me happy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing your joy with us. That is a really joyful perspective, vision, things that we can work more and more towards in our future. Henry, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast, to hear your story. Where can people find out more about you and the work that you do?
Sure, absolutely. They can connect with me on social media. I'm in probably every social media channel you can find. Yeah, just Google Henry Yao and you can find me. If you want to know more about my work, you can also go to the museum's website, cmhouston.org. You can find everything that we're doing for the community.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Henry.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked what you heard, take a minute to share this podcast with a friend or colleague. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your ratings and reviews help us to keep the podcast lights on. We can't do this without your support. Every subscription, share, follow, download, and review makes a big difference and helps others find our show. Also, we love hearing from you. Tell us what you think of the podcast. Email us at hello@thelanguageproject.co. You can also slide into our DMs on Instagram at Talking to Grandma. Talking to Grandma is owned by the Language Preservation Project. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara, and I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. See you next episode.